our study this morning, we're continuing to talk about David, and will throughout the remainder of 2 Samuel. Lots of things to talk about this morning, but we note that 2 Samuel chapter 11 is kind of a landmark chapter in the book of 2 Samuel because it records the sin in particular that David committed with Bathsheba, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. We know that David obviously knew that what he was doing was wrong, but he did it anyway. He sent to his neighbor's house, brought Bathsheba, Uriah's wife, to his house, committed fornication with her. A child was conceived. Then he sought to deceive the husband, Uriah, by bringing him in from the battlefield, ultimately trying to make him drunk and then send him out to the battlefield with his own death warrant, as it were, to be put into the midst of the battle and to withdraw from him. And then he would be slain in battle. And then, of course, David explained it away by saying one dies in battle as another. And then the 12th chapter, the story that Nathan told unto David about a man and his little ewe lamb that was like a daughter to him. How that a rich man had company and had all kinds of herds and flocks, but rather killed that one little ewe lamb of his neighbor's and fed it to his guest. And the text tells us in verse 5 of chapter 12 that David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. And he said to Nathan, "As Jehovah liveth, the man that hath done this is worthy to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold, because he did this thing, and because he had no pity." And Nathan said unto David, "Thou art the man." Of course, he is reminded of the greatness of the blessings that God has bestowed upon him. But being unhappy with those things, he sought to have the wife of Uriah. Now, the thing that we want to begin our study with today, this morning, is seen in the beginning of verse 10, where the writer says, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thy house, because thou hast despised me, and hast taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith Jehovah, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and will take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them unto thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of this son. For thou didst it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." And David said unto Nathan, "I have sinned against Jehovah." And Nathan said unto David, "Jehovah also hath put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die. Howbeit, because by this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of Jehovah to blaspheme, the child also that is born unto thee shall surely die." And Nathan departed into his house, 2 Samuel 12, verse 14. Now, as we look at the consequences that Nathan says unto David are surely to come to pass, we see the severity of them. And as we see them play out, we see them play out perhaps in a way that we might not anticipate as we read further in the text. Now, we know that the child would surely die. And so it was. David prayed unto God and fasted, thinking that perhaps while the child was yet alive, that God might be merciful to him and the child might live. Not so. The child died. And we know that David said that the child, or now that the child is dead, verse 23, he said, "Wherefore should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I shall go to him, but he will not return unto me." We know then in chapter 13 that as a result of the sin that David committed, there's going to be war in his house and evil against his house. You'll note again chapter 12, verse 11, "Evil in your house," and it's going to be there for the rest of David's days. We note that the sword would never depart and trouble would be in his family, and so it came to pass. His wives would be taken by his enemies and be lain with openly as a sign of disgrace to him. And in our last study, we talked about David's lamentation because of his sin, his acknowledgement of his sin. We talked about Psalms 51. I might add to that, I think we mentioned Psalms 32, but I'd add to that Psalm 6 and Psalms 38. If you're taking notes, jot those down and read them when you have time, because these Psalms also, I believe, give us a glimpse of the grief that David had because of the sin that he had committed. But as we see this begin to play out, trouble in his house. Chapter 13, we read about Absalom, Amnon, and Tamar. Now, it was mentioned, I believe, in our last study, or perhaps the study, before that, regarding the relationship of these children to each other. I want to call your attention back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, where we note that David has six wives that are identified in verse 2 through 5. And that helps us, I think, to see the relationship of these children. Notice, if you will, that the third son named of David in verse 3 is Absalom. Of Maacah, the daughter of Talmah, king of Geshur. Now that's going to be important to our study today, because we're going to see that Absalom flees to the land of Geshur. Notice, if you will, that that was the land where his grandfather was, as he flees from David relative to these things. You'll notice in those verses the names of some of these others. The point being is they are sons of different mothers, making them half-brothers and sisters, as we read in chapter 13. So Absalom, the son of David, chapter 13, verse 1, had a fair sister whose name was Tamar. And Amnon, the son of David, loved her. And Amnon was so vexed that he fell sick because of his sister Tamar. Now we might look at occasions such as this and say, what a perversion. And indeed that's so. But we also need to note that often these various wives of a king would reside often in different dwellings and not necessarily have day-to-day contact with each other, and their children day-to-day contact with each other. This man Amnon might see his half-sister, if I may use or coin the expression, at a distance, and not necessarily have day-to-day contact with her. And therefore he has developed these feelings for her. Now we know that after Amnon develops these feelings for his sister, we read about Jonadab, who is a cousin of Amnon, who develops a plan how that Amnon can have his sister. And what was the plan? Right, pretend you're sick, and then ask that Tamar come and cook and fix for you and so forth, care for you, nurse you back to health. And so you can be with her then in a private setting, and that's what was done. And while in this private setting, we find that Amnon raped his sister, Tamar. Now, the thing that's interesting to me about that, two or three things, one is in verse 15, is that Amnon hated her with exceeding great hatred, for the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. So he doesn't want now to have anything to do with her, but orders that she be sent out of the house and the door locked and so forth and so on. He doesn't want to have any responsibility for her. Well, Tamar reacts to what's been done. She had on a beautiful garment that was typical of the daughters of the king, who were yet virgins, and she tears her garment and puts ashes on her head. And in this condition, her brother Absalom finds her and asks the question, "Hath Amnon," verse 20, "thy brother been with thee?" And of course, he has. He's raped her. And the text tells us then in verse 21, When King David heard all these things, he was very wroth. I want to underscore that in your thinking. David was angry with Amnon. But what does he do about it? Nothing. What did the law say that was to be done about it? He's to be put to death. But what had the law said about what David did? He was to be put to death. Now we find that nothing was done in either instance. David was not put to death, and we could speculate some and did Wednesday night. I want to qualify that as speculation. But we might look at David at this point and say, well, Amnon has really not done anything altogether worse than what I did. And so he does nothing. He does nothing. And that becomes, I think, a significant point just a little bit later. But what we note here is in verse 23, it tells us it came to pass after 2 full years that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. In fact, we learn that he invited the king too in the next verse. Often I'm told that it was the practice or the custom when the sheep shearing was done, they would have a great feast. Great big hoorah, as we'd call that in Kentucky. And the idea is to celebrate the accomplishment of this great task. Now, Absalom wants Amnon to go. He has a plan. And his plan is, as he reveals to his servants, when I tell you to smite Amnon, I want you to kill him. And so they comply, and Amnon is killed. In verse 29, we learn that as a result of Amnon being killed, all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up on his mule and fled. Well, word comes to David that all of his sons are dead, and that's not so. Jonadab, who has been the evil conspirator in all of this, made this proposition to Amnon, reports to David that it is not true that all of your sons are dead. Only one is dead. And of course, Amnon is the only one that is dead. But Absalom fled. And that brings us to verse 34 of chapter 13. Verse 34. It says, but Absalom fled, and the young man that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, behold, the king's sons are come, as thy servant said, so it is. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's son came and lifted up their voice and wept, and the king also and all his servants wept very sore. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihur, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur, I guess is the correct pronunciation. Pardon me? Geshur. Okay. And there was there for 3 years. And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, and he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead. Two or three things in that I want to bring to our attention. One is that David is comforted regarding Amnon. What does David understand needed to happen to Amnon? He needed to die. And so his death is certainly justified according to the law. He had done nothing about it, but Absalom has. Secondly, we note that David mourned every day for his son Absalom. Now that's interesting to me because of what Absalom has done. But how long has Absalom been gone? 3 years. And David desires, evidently, that he have some relationship with Absalom, but he's done nothing to retrieve Absalom from Geshur. Wonder why? Well, you can speculate on that as well if you'd like. But he remained there for a period of time. Joab arranges a plan whereby Absalom is to be brought back to Jerusalem. And this particular plan is quite interesting to me. He connives with a woman of Tekoa. evidently a wise woman. And what is it that Joab tells this woman to tell King David? There's a story involved in this, kind of like the story that Nathan told King David. No, that's a little bit later on. That's about the man, Sheba, where she throws the head over the wall. That's another incident, just a little bit later on. This particular woman had two sons. Tell me the story. Okay. Yeah, and when he thinks about it, what does he come up with? There in verse 11, 10 and 11. All right, that's what he does. And of course, the woman says, well, what about all these fellows that are going to come to my house and they're going to fuss and complain, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He said, send them to me. I'll take care of it. And so that was how that was left. In verse 11, it said, then she said, I pray thee, let the king remember Jehovah thy God, that the avenger of blood destroy not any more, and lest they destroy my son. And he said, as Jehovah liveth, there shall not one hair of thy son fall to the earth. Well, the king had the right to do that, didn't he? He could extend pardon, and so he does in this particular case. Now, what's her point? She's got a point to drive home with this. Okay. All right, but what's he done? All right, he's expressed pardon to this fellow. Now, this woman, according to the plot of Joab, there's a point to be made. In verse 12, then the woman said, let thy handmaid, I pray thee, speak a word unto my lord the king. And he said, say on. Now look carefully at this. Verse 13, the woman said, wherefore then hast thou devised such a thing against the people of God? For in speaking this word, the king is as one that is guilty, in that the king did not fetch home again his banished one. For we must needs die, and are as water spilt upon the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. Neither doth God take away life, but deviseth means that he that is banished be not an outcast from him. What's the lesson this woman is trying to tell the king? Well, yeah, this is your son. Now, you've expressed mercy to my son, but what about your son? Now, sometimes we have to stop and think about that. And so David stopped and thought about that. And what does he conclude? He's got a question first for this woman. David, no dummy. Who sent you? Who sent you? Look at verse 18. It said, then the king answered and said unto the woman, hide not from me, I pray thee, aught that I shall ask thee. And the woman said, let my lord the king now speak. And the king said, is this the hand of Joab with thee in all this? And the woman answered and said, as thy soul liveth, my lord the king, none can turn to the right or to the left hand from aught that my lord the king has spoken. For thy servant Joab obeyed me, and he put all these words in the mouth of thy handmaid to change the face of the matter. Hath thy servant Joab done this thing? And my Lord is wise according to the wisdom of an angel of God to know all things that are in the earth. Now, what's the point to be made here? This woman had two sons, and if both of them are killed, I won't have any heirs. And so David extends pardon to the woman's son. Anybody give you any trouble, you send them to me. All right, Mr. David, why have you banished your son and not gone after him? Why have you not done anything about it? David's question is, did Joab have something to do with this? And she assures him, yes, Joab had everything to do with this, and you're very perceptive to see that. All right, that's true. In fact, he has a number of sons through all these wives, and we don't even know exactly how many wives he has. So it's not an exact parallel, no. No, he's not. No. He's carried out justice. Well, now that's a good question, Bruce. I hadn't thought of that. We know that he goes to the land of Gershur, and we know that there were cities scattered out through the land so that supposedly a fellow wouldn't have to travel over a day's journey in order to get to one of the cities of refuge. I don't know, maybe some of you have picked up on that. In my reading, I did not notice that a city is named where Absalom fled. Simply that he went to his grandfather, who was the king of Geshur, there in verse 37. Now, perhaps you've noticed more about that than I have. That would be fine. If you do have that information, bring that to my attention. A Syrian town. Okay. All right. Well, now, was Geshur one of the cities of refuge? You can go back to the book of Joshua and find that out. Yeah. Okay. The cities of refuge are named in Joshua. Beginning in verse 7, we've got Kadesh in Galilee. Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim, Kiriath Arba, the same as Hebron in the hill country of Judah, and beyond the Jordan at Jericho eastward, they assign Bezer in the wilderness in the plain of the tribe of Reuben, and Ramoth in Gilead out of the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan out of the tribe of Manasseh. So to answer your question, no. Geshur was not one of the cities of refuge.
In Joshua 12:13, it says, "Nevertheless, the children of Israel drove not out the Geshurites nor the Maacathites, but Geshur and Maacah dwell in the midst of Israel unto this day."
Okay. So we know that they're identified as a people. We've got a town identified, and we know that Absalom's grandfather was the king of that town, but Geshur was not one of the cities of refuge. So, you know, interestingly enough, Absalom's life is not being sought here. Absalom is not, as Richard rightly pointed out, he's not a criminal, at least not at this point. He's carried out justice against his brother. As difficult as that may be, Amnon, the sentence was death. The point we're making here, and of course the text of chapter 14, is that Absalom and David should be reconciled. They should be brought back together. And this is Joab's desire. We note that as a result of the efforts of Joab and this woman, widow of Tekoa, after 2 years, Absalom is brought back to the city of Jerusalem from Geshur, verse 23. But, verse 24, I want you to look at that. Verse 24 of chapter 14. The king said, "Let him turn to his own house, but let him not see my face." So Absalom turned to his own house and saw not the king's face. King David desires that Absalom come back to Jerusalem, but I don't want to see him. I don't want him in my presence. Well, it's not reconciled, is it? He's back in the same town. How long does he remain in Jerusalem before he actually sees David's face? 2 more years. Now let's do the math. We know that since Amnon was killed, Absalom waited 2 years. Since Amnon committed rape with his sister Tamar, Absalom waited 2 years to kill him. Then once he had killed him, he goes to Geshur where he remains for 3 years. And now he's back in Jerusalem for 2 years. So this is 5 years. 7 years altogether since Amnon killed Tamar. 7 years altogether. But since Absalom has fled, we've got 5 years. Okay? 5 years. And David hasn't seen him. And Absalom has become, I guess you would say, impatient. Look at verse 28. And Absalom dwelt 2 full years in Jerusalem, and he saw not the king's face. And Absalom sent for Joab to send him to the king, but he would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but he would not come. Therefore he said unto his servants, "See, Joab's field is near mine, and he hath barley there. Go and set it on fire." And Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and came to Absalom unto his house. I can't read that hardly without just a little bit of a smile and say, what a way to get him to come. You set his field on fire. He sent for him twice and he didn't come. And when he set his field on fire, now Joab is willing to come and talk with Absalom. Well, Absalom has somewhat of a justified argument. Look at verse 32. Absalom answered Joab, "Behold, I sent unto thee, saying, Come hither, that I may send thee to the king, and say, Wherefore am I come from Geshur? It were better for me to be there still. Now therefore, let me see the king's face, and if there be iniquity in me, let him kill me." Now, what's the point being established here? Does Absalom have a point? Yeah, why am I banished? Why can I not see my father the king? If I've done something worthy of death, then bring on the penalty. Let's get this thing done. Otherwise, I want to go back to Geshur because it's better for me there. David? Good question, you see. Good question. I don't know the answer to that. We know that Amnon deserved to die. That was the penalty stated by law. But nonetheless, there was a judiciary process through which that was to be carried out. And Absalom didn't follow that process. He just gave order. Now, there is a thought here, too, that I would imagine is perhaps one of the reasons Bruce asked, did Absalom flee to one of the cities of refuge? The word avenge or avenger is used in this text. The family of one that is unlawfully killed has the responsibility or opportunity to seek vengeance. An eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, so to speak, as we see under the law. Now, to escape that, if someone has accidentally killed somebody, then he could flee to a city of refuge and escape the wrath of the avenger until things be dealt with through proper channels. I don't know if you were thinking in that vein or not, but it's a legitimate vein, I think, to think in. But nonetheless, if it had been somebody other than Absalom, would it have been considered justice? I don't know. It would not have gone through the judiciary process. Of course, Absalom didn't either. But he had a responsibility to seek vengeance, which he obviously did, even if the object of that was his brother. Yes. And so did David, you see. but he didn't do anything about it. Perhaps, perhaps, perhaps. Yes, Bruce? Well, they thought he was going to kill him, them, so they flee. They thought they did, yeah. They thought they did, yeah. So now we've got Absalom back in Jerusalem, and his father still won't speak to him. But if you'll notice in verse 33 of chapter 14, so Joab came to the king and told him, and when he had called for Absalom, he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. So now Absalom has opportunity to come before the king. But things are still not really resolved. Now, I put this map on here because Geshur is a place that we don't normally associate with a great deal of events. But we see where it is. And, of course, here is Jerusalem, where these events have occurred, where David is and so forth, and where Absalom now has been brought back. But we note that Absalom has been up here for 3 years. And now he's back in Jerusalem for 2 years. And still no reconciliation between he and his father. Any questions or comments just here? Well, that brings us to 2 Samuel chapter 15, a very important chapter in our study. Yes, Randy? Yes. 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 Well, yes. Right. And as far as princely things would be concerned, he appears to still be banished from his. And up to this point, Joab hadn't been talking to him. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. Well, the troubles, you remember, are going to be in David's house. I want you to look at that back over in chapter 12. Troubles in David's house. They're going to get worse. In chapter 15, it tells us it came to pass after this that Absalom prepared him a chariot and horses and 50 men to run before him. So he's making a grand stand to announce his position. I'm back, so to speak. And he sets himself up as a judge in the land. You'll notice in verse 3, Absalom said to this particular servant of one of the tribes, as it were, "See, thy matters are good and right, but there is no man deputed of the king to hear thee." Absalom said, moreover, "Oh, that I were made judge in the land, that every man who hath any suit or cause would come unto me, and I would do him justice." Now, what's Absalom advertising? I'm a righteous guy. That's right. If you've got any problem with anybody, you bring that to me, and I'll take care of it. Now, that would make you quite popular, wouldn't it? A politician, somewhat, wouldn't it? Well, if you'll notice in verse 6, it says, "And on this matter did Absalom to all Israel that came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." Now, David's no dummy. David is to be the one before whom folks come to settle some of these kind of things. And Absalom catches them before they get to the king and says, "You bring it to me and I'll settle it and I'll do you right." And so folks are stopping off at Absalom before they get to David. And Absalom's making friends. Now, what's he doing? He's building up himself, that's right, before the people. He's playing politics. Now, if you look at verse 7, it says, it came to pass at the end of 40 years. Some of you in your Bible may have a footnote there for that word 40. That indicates that some translations render that 4. I prefer the number 4 as far as the math is concerned, because how long was David king? David was king for 40 years, so that wouldn't fit with the timeline. But it seems that at the end of 4 years that Absalom has pretty well established himself in terms of popularity. And so his desire is to, what's the word that we use in our vernacular, set forth a coup. He's going to take over the kingdom. He wants to take his father's throne. And he thinks he has enough following to do that. Now, in order to accomplish that, let's read beginning at verse 10. It says, "But Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as ye hear the sound of the trumpet, then ye shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men out of Jerusalem that were invited, and went in their simplicity, and they knew not anything. And Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gileonite, David's counselor, from his city, even from Giloh, where he was offering the sacrifices. And the conspiracy was strong, for the people increased continually with Absalom." Tell me Ahithophel's involvement in all of this. David, who's Ahithophel? Anybody? Pardon me? Bathsheba's grandfather. All right. Well, that makes him an old man, for one, but what position does he hold to the king? He's the counselor to the king. Now, why does Absalom go to Ahithophel? It'd be a good political move. Yeah, very good answer. All right, we got the fellow now that's advising the king on my side. He's on my side. And if you'll note in verse 13, "There came a messenger to David, said, the hearts of the men of Israel are after Absalom. And David said unto all his servants that were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, for else none of us shall escape from Absalom." What's David's concern? Why does he want to flee? Not just simply for his own personal safety, not just simply that Absalom's going to kill those who are with me, but if a war takes place, where is David? Trapped. And trapped where? In Jerusalem. But what's the significance of Jerusalem? It's the city of David. That's right. This was close to David's heart, shall I say. He didn't want the battle to take place there. He didn't want the people that were there to be involved in the battle. In other words, let's take the battle someplace else. Okay, and that was his desire. But he left, in verse 16, 10 women that were concubines to keep the house. Very important, I want you to note that. When you're looking at this map, we have located on this map the supposed path that David took. I always call this word Mahanaim, and I've mispronounced it so many years it's difficult for me to try to say it correctly. Mahanaim is, I believe, the name of this place. But we know that David crosses over the brook Kidron and comes down to the river of Jordan. Now, if you'll look at the maps that we've used previously, perhaps you don't need to do that, but you have topographical maps in your lesson book that show this area. When David is going from Jerusalem down to the Jordan River, we know that there's a great decline in elevation. Jerusalem's elevation was something in the neighborhood of 2,500, 2,800 feet thereabouts in elevation. When you come down to the Jordan River, I generally use the Dead Sea as a reference point. What was the elevation of the Dead Sea? About 1,300 feet below sea level. So from Jerusalem, David is descending down into the valley, the Jordan River Valley. And it's his desire to camp there. But let's read just a little bit. In verse 25 of chapter 15, the king said unto Zadok, "Carry back the ark of God into the city. If I shall find favor in the eyes of Jehovah, he will bring me again and show me both it and his habitation. But if he say, 'Thus I have no delight in thee,' behold, here I am. Let him do to me as seemeth good unto him." I want you to observe just here that not only has David left the city of Jerusalem, but we note that Abiathar and Zadok and the Levites bring the Ark of the Covenant to David. Now, what was the significance of the Ark of the Covenant? The presence of God. That's right. Now, David said, "Take the Ark of the Covenant back." You see, it very well may be what's happening to me is the judgment of God because of what I did back there with Bathsheba. These are consequences. And David's full well aware that this may be a part of God's judgment upon him because God no longer delights in him. And if that be so, that be so. And you'll note in verse 28, he says, "I'll tarry at the fords in the wilderness until there come word from you to certify me." And Zadok, therefore, and Abiathar carried the ark of God again to Jerusalem, and they abode there. Now David said, as he went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives, he covered his head, he went barefoot, and the text tells us that he went up weeping. And in verse 31, it tells us that one told David, saying, "Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom." And David said, "O Jehovah, I pray thee, turn the counsel of Ahithophel into foolishness." Now, here are some points, facts I want you to remember. Remember who Ahithophel is. Ahithophel has been the counselor to David, who has now betrayed David. He has now become the counselor of Absalom, David's son, David's enemy. But you'll also note that a man by the name of Hushai, the Archite, came to meet David, and he rent his clothes, and he had dirt on his head. And in verse 33, David said to him, "If thou passeth on with me, then thou wilt be a burden unto me." Notice, if you will, that Hushai is a very old man and very close to David. And David realizes that the best thing you can do is to go back to Jerusalem. And what I want you to do is to pretend to be an ally to Absalom. And you be my spy. You learn anything that I need to know. You send word to me, and then I'll know that information. So Hushai goes back to Jerusalem and becomes a spy for David. Now we know that Ahithophel and Abishai now are in a position really to be counselors to Absalom, the son, the enemy of David. And I want you to look in chapter 16. Chapter 16 sets an interesting stage. I'm just going to mention this in brief. We know that a fellow by the name of Shimei, in verse 5, who is identified as the son of Gera, came out and cursed and cast stones at David and made all kinds of ugly sayings to David. In fact, if you'll note in verse 7, he said, "Begone, begone, thou man of blood, a base fellow, Jehovah hath returned upon thee the blood of the house of Saul, in whose stead thou hast reigned. And Jehovah hath delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom thy son. And behold, thou art taken in thine own mischief, because thou art a man of blood." Now, this fellow, Shemaiah, can you picture David, the king of these people? He's left Jerusalem, and things are not good. People are throwing rocks at him and saying ugly things to him, very dishonorable things. And then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said unto the king, "Why should this dead dog curse my lord the king?" What is it that Abishai wants to do to him? I'm going to kill him. He's saying bad things about the king. I'm going to kill him. What's David say to Abishai? "No, we're not going to kill him." Why not? All right. There might be some truth in what he said. I've not been a good fellow. Now, here we see the humility of David. You see, this very well may be justice upon me, because look at what I did to Uriah with Bathsheba and all those ugly things that I did. So let him alone. Let him curse. For it could very well be that Jehovah hath bidden him. You see that in verse 11? And then in verse 12, it may be that look on the wrong done unto me and requite me good for his cursing. Now, that might satisfy the wrath of God because of the ugly things that I've done. And so Shimei went along the hillside and continued to curse and continued to cast stones at David and his men as they went. Now, in verse 15, we know that Ahithophel and Hushai, the Archite, came to Absalom. And Hushai said unto Absalom, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" How does Absalom, David's son, David's enemy, how does he respond to these words from, of all people, Hushai? "Now, why aren't you over there with David?" And what does Hushai say? How does he explain, "Now that I've come back to Jerusalem and I'm saying, long live the king, I'm declaring you to be the king, why do I express loyalty to you?" How does Hushai explain this?
"The people of Israel selected you."
All right, the people of Israel have selected you and they've banished David. So, I'm going to be faithful to you. Well, was he telling the truth? No. No, he was not telling the truth. In verse 20, it tells us, "Then said Absalom to Ahithophel, give your counsel. What shall I do?" So Ahithophel tells Absalom that what you need to do is that you need to go in unto your father's concubines and declare unto all Israel that you're the king. Now, we've noted that taking a previous king's wives and concubines was one of the ways that victory was celebrated. And so now it would appear that Absalom has gained the victory. This is what Ahithophel has told him that he should do. And in verse 23, just a quick note, it tells us that the counsel of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if a man inquired at the oracle of God. Ahithophel's counsel was very gravely respected. And so we have to talk a lot more about that. So we'll start then with 2 Samuel chapter 16, there about verse 20, and then on into chapter 17 in our next study. Wednesday night. Gets exciting, the counsel of Ahithophel versus the counsel of Hushai, and how that all is played out.